You're listening to DTFHN for July 27th, 2026. I'm your mass-produced but still artisanal host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who could build anything argue about everything. Today smells like open blueprints and old math that still holds up. Let's get into it. 3 trillion parameters. Open weights. Free to download. Let's sit with that number for a second. Not because big numbers are inherently impressive, but because of what it reveals about where we actually are. Moonshot AI, a Beijing-based lab, just dropped Kimi K3 on Hugging Face, the world's first open 3 trillion parameter model. And the question nobody in Silicon Valley wants to answer is simple. Why can't the companies with 10,000 times more resources do this? One of the comments on the release page puts it perfectly. If you described what's happening right now to someone 5 years ago, they'd think you were hallucinating. Raw intelligence, frontier class, sitting on a public page for anyone to download. No API key, no enterprise sales call. No terms of service that let the provider yank your access when the wind changes. The architecture is genuinely interesting. They're calling it Kimi Delta Attention with Attention Residuals. A new approach to how the model processes context, and that context window is built for repository-scale code understanding. Not chatbot scale, not summarize, this email scale, repository scale, the kind of sustained reasoning you need for real engineering work. Multi-step planning, tool calling, browsing, native agentic, capabilities baked into the architecture, not bolted on after the fact. Now, the practical question, the comments are already circling. Who can actually run this thing? 3 trillion parameters in mixed precision 4-bit quantization is still an enormous amount of compute. The hardware landscape for individuals is, as one commenter noted, shaped wrong. You're either crawling at 5 tokens per second on unified memory, or you need data center cards with hundreds of gigabytes of VRAM. But that's a hardware problem, not an access problem. And hardware problems get solved. The weights being open means 1,000 teams can figure out how to serve this efficiently, how to distill it, how to run it on whatever silicon shows up next year. Meanwhile, the pricing data is already telling. GLM 5.2 saw prices drop 45% in 6 weeks after release. Competition does that. Open weights do that. When the model is public, the margin on inference collapses toward the cost of electricity. That's not a bug. That's the point. Moonshot AI just put a 3 trillion parameter model where anyone can reach it. The tools exist. The weights are available. The only question left is what gets built with them. Moving on. Someone built a working model of the PostgreSQL engine as a city. Like an actual visual city. Buildings for the shared buffer pool. Roads for the wall pipeline. Little animated processes moving between structures like commuters who really, really care about MVCC. PG Sim City took less than 48 hours to build. That fact alone should make every technical writer who spent 6 months on a database internals book feel a very specific kind of emotion. Not anger, exactly. More like watching someone parallel park a bus on their first try. Now here's where I want to play devil's advocate for a moment. The comments immediately split into two camps. Camp 1, this is incredible. I finally understand how vacuum works. Camp 2, this was vibe-coded in 2 days. Is any of it actually true? And Camp 2 has a point. A beautiful animated lie about how PostgreSQL handles transaction isolation is arguably worse than no explanation at all. Anti-knowledge, someone called it. fair concern. Except, and this is the part that makes me laugh. The project is on GitHub. Open issue is pull request welcome. The creator put a disclaimer right at the top, practically begging people to correct the inaccuracies. That's not how anti-knowledge works. Anti-knowledge hides behind paywalls and proprietary documentation that never gets updated. Anti-knowledge is a $500 conference talk with no recording. This is the opposite. This is someone saying, here's my best understanding, rendered as a city. Please tell me where I'm wrong. And the unintended consequence, nobody's talking about. One commenter immediately imagined typing a SQL query and watching it flow through the entire system, from parser to planner to executor to storage. That feature doesn't exist yet. But someone just described it in a comment, and because the code is open, someone else can build it. That's how open tooling compounds. You ship something imperfect on a Tuesday, and by Thursday, a stranger has imagined the version you couldn't. The real comedy here is that PostgreSQL itself has some of the best documentation of any open source project in existence. Hundreds of pages, meticulous, comprehensive, and apparently what people actually needed was a cartoon city, which, honestly, tracks. The knowledge was always available. The bottleneck was never accessed. It was the translation layer between how databases work and how human brains want to receive that information. Somebody closed that gap with vibe coding and a SimCity metaphor in a weekend. The prototype is rough. The accuracy needs review. The code is right there. That's how this is supposed to go. Moving on. In Utahner, the Theron Carpenter sat in his office at Boeing and wrote a program to render fractally generated mountains. Nobody asked him to. There was no product roadmap. He just wanted to see if a computer could produce terrain that looked real. That demo eventually became the rendering techniques behind the Genesis sequence in Star Trek II. The first fully computer-generated movie sequence ever filmed. One engineer, one curiosity. One weekend project that redrew the boundary of what screens could show. Now someone has done the same thing with a black hole in your browser. Using your phone camera. The craft here deserved a close look. Gravitational lensing. The way a black hole warps space-time so severely that light curves around it is described by geodesic equations in general relativity. Solving those equations in real time, on commodity hardware, through a web browser, while compositing the result over a live camera feed? That is a genuinely hard graphics problem. The photon sphere, the accretion disk, the way background light gets Einstein-ringed into arcs. All of it computed per frame. The developer is essentially running a simplified general relativity solver in WebGL and shipping it as a URL you can text to your friend. There's a concept in classical music called a reduction. You take a full orchestral score and compress it for solo piano. You lose the timbres, the spatial separation, the sheer mass of sound, but a good reduction preserves the architecture. The harmonics are intact. The structure is faithful. That's what this project does with astrophysics. It's a reduction of general relativity to something your phone can play back in your living room. The physics aren't research grade. One commenter correctly noted is visualization grade, not simulation grade. But the architecture is honest. The geodesics are real. The math is right where it matters. And the thing that makes this worth talking about. It's open, npm install, npm run dv, the rendering pipeline, the lensing math, the AR compositing layer, all of it sits there for the next person to fork and improve. Someone will make the accretion disk more accurate. Someone else will port the lensing shader to a different engine. The project doesn't need to be perfect because it's not a product. It's a starting point. Loring Carpenter didn't ship a movie. he shipped a possibility. 48 years later, the tradition holds. One engineer, one curiosity, one URL that bends light. So we've been bending light. But what happens when you zoom the timeline back far enough that even bees haven't shown up yet? When you're designing a system, there's a moment where you choose your interface. You pick what you're going to talk to, how you're going to talk to it, and you commit. Every decision after that flows downstream from that one choice. I've watched teams agonize over API design for weeks, trying to future-proof against clients that don't exist yet. Magnolia's didn't have that luxury. They picked their interface 100 million years ago, and they're still running on it. Magnolia flowers are pollinated by beetles. Not bees. Not butterflies. Beetles, and the reason is pure chronology. Magnolias evolved during the Cretaceous period. Bees hadn't shown up yet. Beetles had been around for 300 million years. By that point, ancient even by the standards of ancient things. The magnolia didn't choose beetles because they were optimal. It chose beetles because beetles were there. This reminds me of something Ken Thompson said about Unix. That it wasn't designed to be the best system. It was designed to be good enough with what was available. The PDP-7 wasn't the ideal machine, but Thompson wrote for the hardware he had, and the constraints shaped something that turned out to be remarkably durable. The Magnolia did the same thing, just 65 million years early. Look at the engineering. The flower is bowl-shaped because beetles can't hover. They need to land and crawl. The petals are thick and leathery because beetles are clumsy. They chew, they stumble, they plow through. A delicate orchid would get shredded. The magnolia built for the client it actually had, not the graceful pollinator it might have wished for. And the scent. Magnolias smell like fermenting fruit because that's what beetles navigate by. Not color, not ultraviolet patterns, the way bees read flowers. Scent. The entire sensory interface was tuned to the consumer. The pollination itself is almost accidental. Beetles aren't collecting nectar. They're just eating and blundering around, getting coated in pollen as a side effect. It's not elegant. It's a hack. But it's a hack that has been running in production for 100 million years without a patch. Now, some commenters pointed out that bees do visit magnolias today, and that's true, but that's not the design. That's incidental compatibility. Like running a 30-year-old C program on modern hardware. The original contract was with beetles, and the architecture still shows it. Sometimes the best system isn't the most sophisticated one. It's the one that shipped. 5 stories in, and we're still finding things that ship lean and just work. This one's no exception. What does a language runtime actually owe you? Strip it down. A runtime is a contract. You hand over source code. It hands back behavior. The question is, how much machinery sits between those 2 points? For TypeScript, the answer has historically been a lot. Your code compiles to JavaScript, which loads into V8 or SpiderMonkey, which JIT compiles it again, which manages garbage collection, which maintains an event loop. Layers on layers. Each one exists because the language was designed for browsers. And browsers needed flexibility more than they needed speed. Script C asks a different question. How much of that flexibility do you actually use? The answer, for most TypeScript, is almost none. Vercel's compiler analyzes your code construct by construct and reports back. Of 4,400 statements in your app, 4,451 compile to native code. The remaining 30 need a small embedded engine. Everything is explicit. You see exactly what compiled and what didn't. with error codes and rewrite hints for anything that falls outside the static surface. The technical approach is worth examining. Generics get monomorphized. Classes compile with true dynamic dispatch to virtualized when the compiler can prove it's safe. A sync and await run on stackful fibers with JavaScript exact scheduling. Closures preserve JS capture semantics. Discriminated unions become tagged values driven by TypeScript's own type narrowing. The standard library is re-implemented with byte exact compatibility. UTF schedule strings, JS ordered maps and sets, a full-on node API surface including HTTP, TOS, failed save team, child proselyte. The output is 100 and 178 kilobyte binary with 2 milliseconds startup. No node, no V8, no engine in the binary at all. Unless your code needs one. Now, the comments are skeptical, and the skepticism breaks into two camps. One says this is a publicity play. Vercel shipping something flashy to stay in the news cycle. The other points to Porfer, an independent project chasing the same goal that still only passes 68% of Test 262 after years of work. Both observations are fair. Compiling a dynamic language to native code is genuinely hard, and the gap between demo and production is where most compilers go to die. Other artifact is real. The coverage tool is real. The decision to make every compilation boundary visible to the developer. That's a design choice that respects the person writing the code. It says, here's what we can do, here's what we can't, and here's exactly where the line is. The tools exist. Whether they survive contact with the NPM ecosystem at scale is the only question that matters now. We talked about things surviving extreme conditions earlier. Well, French firefighters just encountered an entirely new kind of extreme. Let me make the case for complacency. France has world-class firefighting infrastructure. Europe's climate models are sophisticated. The Mediterranean has always burned. Wildfires are a known quantity. You map the fuel, you predict the wind, you deploy resources along predictable fire fronts. The system works. It has worked for decades. Except a pyrocumulonimbus doesn't care about your system. What happened outside Bordeaux this week broke the operational model French firefighters have trained on for their entire careers. A wildfire burned so hot that it superheated the air column above it, launching moisture-stripped atmosphere into the upper troposphere where it condensed into a cloud. Cloud born from fire, generating its own wind patterns, its own lightning, striking the ground below and igniting new fronts in every direction simultaneously. 200,000 people evacuated. The fire 10 miles from a major European city. And the lead spokesman for France's National Fire Service used a phrase I have never heard from an official source before. Operational impossibility. Followed the logic of preparedness to its conclusion. You can model fire spread in a cone. You can position crews upwind. You can cut fire breaks ahead of a front. All of this assumes the fire behaves like a thermodynamic process you can predict. A convective fire that manufactures its own weather is not that process. It is a phase transition. The fire has crossed a threshold where it becomes a self-reinforcing system, feeding itself with the very atmosphere it destabilizes. Your models don't break gradually. They break completely. The land forest burning right now is itself an engineered landscape. Planted under Napoleon III to drain marshland, monoculture pine, resin-rich, drought stressed after consecutive dry years. One commenter who studies forest disturbance from satellite imagery noted this single region contains all four major disturbance types. Wind, fire, pest, harvest. Overlapping in the same canopy. It is a system optimized for timber yield, not resilience. Lieutenant Colonel Brocardi said, salvation comes from the sky or from steering the fire toward the sea. That is not a tactical plan. That is an honest admission that the boundary conditions have changed, and the old playbook is ACT. This is not a story about failure. The firefighters defending critical sites, rescuing animals, holding the line while knowing they cannot win. That is precisely the kind of determined, clear-eyed work that matters most when systems exceed their design parameters. But the design parameters have been exceeded. Australia and Canada have known this for years. France knows it now. The question is not whether this will happen again. The question is, what gets rebuilt? And whether it gets rebuilt for the climate that existed or the one that's arriving. Now, rebuilding for the world that's arriving takes silicon, and China just made a dramatic bet on making its own. 470%. A Chinese memory chip maker lists on the NASDAQ and nearly quintuples before most analysts have finished their morning coffee. One commenter's response captures the room perfectly. Let's see them ship some chip first. That skepticism is earned. CXMT makes DRAM. Dynamic random access memory, the commodity silicon that lives in everything from your phone to your data center. It is not exotic. It is not novel. DRAM is a brutal, capital-intensive business where margins are thin and the incumbents. Samsung, SK Hynix, Micron have spent decades and hundreds of billions of dollars building fabs that operate at the ragged edge of physics. A 470% surge on listing day is not a verdict on technology. It is a verdict on narrative. And the narrative is potent. China wants memory independence the way a landlocked country wants a port. The U.S. export controls on advanced chips and chip-making equipment have turned domestic semiconductor capacity into a national security priority, which means CXMT isn't just a company. It's a policy instrument with a stock ticker. Investors aren't pricing the DRAM. They're pricing the geopolitical hedge. One commenter draws the SK Hynix parallel, and it's apt. South Korea deliberately built a national champion in memory. It worked, but it worked over decades. With massive state subsidy, and SK Hynix still nearly went bankrupt twice along the way. The question for CXMT is whether the Chinese state's willingness to absorb losses indefinitely changes that equation or just delays the reckoning. Meanwhile, someone points at the EU chip industry and says, best I can do is eat glue in the corner. That lands because it's true. Europe has been talking about semiconductor sovereignty for years and has almost nothing to show for it. The lesson is clarifying. Sovereignty in silicon is not a policy paper. It is a fab. You either build the thing or you don't. The deeper thread worth pulling is what another commenter flagged. That state-of-the-art AI performance may not require terabytes of memory for much longer. If inference gets radically more efficient, the entire demand curve for high-bandwidth memory shifts. CXMT could be building capacity for a market that's about to transform underneath them. But today, none of that matters. Today, 470% is the number. And the number is doing all the talking. Now for something completely different. Forget memory chips. Let's talk about something beautiful. Piper card shipped in 1997 and Apple killed it in 2004. Which is one of those decisions that makes perfect sense if your business model is selling platforms and no sense at all if your business model is empowering humans. Because HyperCard had a problem. It let ordinary people make software, click a button, draw a card, wire them together. No Xcode, no developer account, no 30% cut. just people building things for themselves and sharing them with each other. Strategically inconvenient. Decker picks up that thread and runs it somewhere Apple never would. It's a multimedia authoring environment. Images, sound, hypertext, scripted behavior. Built on a wub-bit ditherpunk aesthetic that looks like it fell out of a 1991 System 7 screenshot. And here's the architectural choice that matters. Every deck you build exports as a single self-contained HTML file. One file. No server, no framework, no dependency chain. You drag it to a web host and it runs. You email it to someone and it runs. You put it on a USB drive in a drawer and in 10 years, assuming browsers still render HTML. Which, let's be honest, they will. It still runs. Run that forward. We have spent 20 years building a web that requires build systems to produce build systems. Ticker's answer is a format so simple, it fits in a text file that plays nice with Git. The scripting language, Lil, borrows from Lua and APL. Imperative enough to be familiar. Functional enough to be powerful. With implicit vector arithmetic baked in, so you can do interesting things in three lines instead of 30. The real punchline is in the project's own description. No advertising. No telemetry. No gamification. No. And I'm quoting directly. Slop generator integration in 2006. A software project has to explicitly promise it won't shove generative AI into your creative tool. That's the state of the industry. That's the comedy. MIT licensed, builds from source. The interpreter compiles to a cross-platform executable. There's a version that runs on POSIX AWK, which is the kind of beautiful, unnecessary flex that only happens when someone is building for joy rather than quarterly earnings. The tools exist. They're free. Go make something weird with them. A U.S. citizen's Graffinone's phone wiped itself during an airport search. Pause. And now they're facing federal charges for it. 18 lines of code. That's roughly what it takes to implement a duress pin in an Android-based operating system. You catch the unlock attempt. You check it against a stored hash. And if it matches the wipe trigger, you call the device admin API's wipe data method. It is, from an engineering standpoint, trivially simple, which is exactly what makes this federal case in Atlanta so revealing. Sam Tunick, a U.S. citizen, lands at Hartsfield-Jackson after a trip to the Dominican Republic. Federal agents pull him aside. They've already circulated his photo internally, flagging him for suspected terrorism ties because of his alleged connection to protests against Cop City, a $109 million police training facility. According to his defense filing, he asked for a lawyer four times denied. No warrant presented. No rights read. When agents demanded his passcode, he eventually provided one. The phone wiped itself. Now the Department of Justice wants to prosecute him under a federal statute for destroying property to prevent seizure. And the property in question is data on a phone running Graphene O. Here's what matters technically. Graphene OS is open source. Every line of its code is auditable. The duress wipe feature isn't hidden. It isn't obfuscated. It's a documented security mechanism that exists because the project's contributors decided users deserve a last line of defense for their data. This is the same class of feature as full disk encryption, as secure boot, as remote wipe capabilities that ship on every corporate managed iPhone in every Fortune 500 company. The difference is that Graphene OS puts that capability in the hands of individuals instead of IT departments. And that's the bootstrapism question laid bare In Catalonia, police are profiling people carrying Pixel phones, assuming Graphene OS means drug dealer. In France, authorities treat the OS itself as suspicious. A U.S. prosecutor is now arguing that a documented feature of an open-source operating system constitutes criminal intent. The code is public, the feature is transparent, the architecture is open. What's being criminalized isn't secrecy. It's the act of an individual exercising the same data sovereignty that every corporation takes for granted. The tools exist. The question is whether you're allowed to use them. Let's shift gears entirely, from courtroom drama to pure engineering joy. How do you run a spell checker in 64 kilobytes of RAM? 13.60 bits per word. Douglas McElroy compressed an entire English dictionary to within 300ths of a bit of the theoretical minimum. In use in 1976 on a machine with 64 kilobytes of RAM, nobody has beaten that number since. The question nobody asks about old Unix is why it was so good. Not nostalgically good. Not good for its time good. Measurably, mathematically provably good in ways that 50 years of Moore's Law haven't improved upon. Here's what McElroy actually did. The PDP-11 couldn't hold a 250 kilobyte dictionary. Modern GZIP can't even compress that file below 85K. Generic compression was a dead end. Instead of fighting the general problem, he studied the specific one. He built a stemming algorithm. Linguistic, not statistical. That collapsed the dictionary down 25,000 root words. Then he needed a data structure for fast lookups in the remaining memory. First attempt, a Bloom filter. Possibly one of the first production deployments of that data structure anywhere. Dennis Ritchie wrote the implementation. They tuned the false positive rate low enough that they never needed to hit the actual dictionary on disk. That's three Bell Labs engineers. MCCROY Ritchie Johnson. Collaborating on a spell checker. The density of TAL is almost absurd. When the dictionary grew to 30,000 words, the Bloom filter couldn't fit anymore. McElroy went deeper. He computed 27-bit hash codes, sorted them, took the differences between consecutive values, and discovered those differences followed a geometric distribution. Then he found Golem coding, a compression scheme purpose-built for geometric distributions, and achieved 13.60 bits per word against a theoretical floor of 13.57. That's not engineering. That's craftsmanship at the boundary of information theory. And the whole thing was open, published, documented, available for anyone to study and build on. The algorithm survived not because AT&T protected it, but because McElroy shared it. 50 years later, it's still the benchmark. Not because nobody's tried to beat it, but because he found the floor and essentially sat down on it. The tools existed. He let other people reach them. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for July 27, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Sonnet 4.7. Voice by Quinn 3 TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something worth sharing. We'll see you back here tomorrow.